This is KYUK, public radio for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. I'm Evan Erickson. The Coast Guard rescued four people trapped in a boat near the community of Chifornik over the weekend. No injuries have been reported. The Coast Guard Arctic District received a request for assistance Saturday afternoon from the Alaska State Troopers. The passengers, three adults and one child, were subsistence hunting for seal and had been trapped on an ice floe for over 24 hours, roughly 10 miles from Chifornik. The group was able to free their boat, but were unable to reach an onshore party of snow machiners due to moving ice. A Coast Guard air crew arrived via helicopter around 5 a.m. on Sunday morning and was able to lift all four passengers onto the aircraft. They were then transported back to Chifornik. Lieutenant Commander Alexis Chavarria Aguilar, the helicopter's pilot, said in a release that it was one of the most challenging missions any of us had ever flown, citing near-zero visibility as well as icing conditions. The rescue mission was aided by the three forms of communication the passengers had with them, which included a satellite device, according to a report from the Coast Guard. At a recent science conference in Bethel, elders and community members spoke about changes in weather patterns they've experienced on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. That included ex-typhoon Halong, which devastated parts of the region this past October. KYUK's Samantha Watson reports how a shifting environment is impacting community members of all ages.
Growing up in Chifornik, Jessica Lewis Nickerai says her dad taught her how to listen to the weather.
Go outside, look at the sunrise, look at the water. When the sun would have sundogs, he would make sure he's warm.
Now, she says, she gives that same advice to her younger cousins before they go out hunting on a boat.
Just watch the weather. I know you can look it up on your phone, but my dad used to look at the clouds.
Nickerai told this story while she was on a panel at the Western Alaska Interdisciplinary Science Conference. She and other YK Delta community members, elders, and researchers explored shifts in weather patterns and flood events on the YK Delta in a multi-part panel called Changing Landscapes. This included touching on last year's typhoon, which displaced whole villages in October. Several of the panelists felt the effects of that storm, including Quiggilingok elder Fred Phillip. He says he feels there was a shift in weather events around the time of the 1964 earthquake that struck Alaska. In the memory of his community, that's around when storms began to feel more intense.
My first observation was back in mid-70s, where the storm practically covered the whole village. The infrastructure, the boardwalks.
He remembers the community's resilience. They came together to mend the boardwalks, but they were told it was a sign of a bigger shift.
Our elders told us at community meetings, the weather, the climate is changing. They didn't use the word climate change, but that's what they were telling us.
He says he remembers elders saying there would be changes in the winter. They wouldn't be cold like they used to be. Anthropologist Anne Finep Reardon presented testimonies from interviews collected in her work about the changing weather on the YK Delta. Pete Jacobs of Bethel had spoken similarly about his elders.
He said they'd mentioned that the weather wasn't like it was in the past. They tried to understand what caused it to become that way. People said in the past that the weather has become like this following its people.
The conference carried iterations of this sentiment, a teaching that the weather follows the behavior of its people. Here's conference organizer Katie Basil.
If the weather is changing because of our behavior in a way that's scary, we can change our behavior to change the weather again.
Environmental changes have informed reality for some of the YK Delta's youngest generation. University of Alaska Fairbanks undergraduate students Daisy Carl and Glenisha Carl grew up in Newtok, a community that faced years of worsening environmental impacts and erosion. In 2024, after a decades-long process, the village officially relocated to a new site, Makhtavik. Here's Daisy.
My family was one of the first families to move to Makhtavik, but I did my first everything in Newtok. I took my first steps and went on my first bike ride there, little me was thinking about having a future at Newtok.
Both students were part of a project documenting the human impacts of climate change on their community. Glenisha says she's also been writing about her experience while in college.
For my classes at University of Alaska Fairbanks, I wrote a bunch of essays and poems about what Newtok was like. I was surprised how much people didn't know about Newtok. Many residents of Alaska that I spoke to also haven't heard about us.
She says spreading awareness about communities hard hit by climate change can help bring in more funding. She says she stands by the communities impacted by Halong who are seeking to relocate.
I want people to show more empathy for Kipnuk and Kuiganga. It's their first time. For us, we had to do fundraising and apply for so many grants.
Carl says she saw firsthand how working together as a community made the process much easier. She also says she hopes more communities will involve youth and kids' voices when it comes to environmental change. In Bethel, I'm Samantha Watson.
Alaska Native people make up less than 20% of Alaska's population, but they represent more than 40% of the state's prison population. And when they're released, Alaska Native people have a 60% chance of ending up back in prison, the highest rate of all racial and ethnic groups in the state, according to the Alaska Department of Corrections. As part of a crime bill passed by the legislature 2 years ago, the Department of Corrections contracted with the Alaska Federation of Natives to conduct a study looking at ways to reduce the overrepresentation of Alaska Native people in the state's prison population. The study was released recently. AFN's Director of Government Relations, Kendra Closter, was part of the team that put the study together. She told Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early that many issues surrounding Alaska Native incarceration can be attributed to historical traumas the population has faced in the state.
I think what's important here to first kind of set the stage and thinking about this, Alaska Native people had a restorative justice system where, you know, we're addressing and uplifting our youth and having our youth and elders together and growing up. And we had such a strong system in which there was support. When you come through colonization, you have a Western system that was built so much different than the way our Alaska Native people lived. You have a long history of trauma since contact that has been embedded into our communities, and those are traumas that are still living on today. And I think that that does have a lot of impacts onto what our current system is looking at. And so when we're looking at saying that we have these high rates, there's a number of things that need to be looked at and understood.
You mentioned that one of the recommendations the study puts forward is the expansion of restorative justice programs. How do those programs work differently from more Western justice systems, and why do you think they'd produce better outcomes?
I'm going to give kind of an example to help maybe highlight this. Let's say our youth have we'll call it a youthful indiscretion, and they, say, go out and do vandalism. In a Western system, you're looking at more of like, we're going to go to a court appearance. You're going to have something on your record. You're going to be put down a path that is not really looking toward restoring individuals and really just understanding that what happened. So in our restorative kind of justice programs and through a tribal court, you would see these youth come into a circle with our elders, with our aunties, with our uncles. They will love you up in a very stern kind of way. They're going to say, you know, we love you. You messed up though. And what you're going to do now is you're going to go back to those individuals and you're going to do something to make them whole. And you're going to understand what that is. Maybe that's going in and fixing what they vandalized. Maybe that's going in and fishing for that family. You're going to hold some personal accountability to yourself and to the community and understanding that. That is a restorative justice system where we're understanding, we're uplifting our youth, we are taking them and making them part of the solution to fix what went wrong.
So a part of the study talks about the importance of keeping people in their communities, especially when it comes to things like parole requirements. Why do you think staying close to home matters so much for addressing recidivism rates?
Through this study, when we did interviews and surveys, we talked with individuals, this was something that came up pretty often. is, let's say if you're from a rural community and you're in an urban hub, you go into a correctional system and you come out and you have parole and probation requirements that are keeping you in the city. However, maybe your home base is where you're going to have a better chance. You might have a home there, you have family support, but yet these probation and parole violation or requirements are not allowing you to go home, and you have to stay within that city. And if you don't have that support system, you could end up homeless. You could end up, you know, kind of re-back in the system because you don't have that support system. And so that had come up pretty often. And so that was one of the recommendations, is can we look at the probation and parole violations? What needs to change in there? And how are we supporting those individuals?
So in what ways do you think that the state can address some of these recommendations in sort of more immediate terms and then in the longer term?
Looking at the longer term, it's really looking at the preventative measures. And a lot of that is going to be putting effort into education, prenatal care, supporting parents. There is a lot of studies, not just ours, that we looked at. We did a literature review to see what other studies have said. And from, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they're saying the same thing. This isn't new information. Is we really need to be making sure that we're supporting parents, that we're supporting kids from the very early ages. And I also want to say, cultural programs play such an important role in our lives, especially for Native people. We are connected to land. We're connected to our hunting and to our fishing. This is part of our wellness. This is part of who we are and our spirituality. This is something that we've talked a lot about within other organizations, and even following up on the study, is how are we building that into our correctional facilities, giving people that are there that connection to their culture, because that is part of the healing process and it's being missed.
That was AFN's Director of Government Relations, Kendra Closter, speaking with Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early. The full study can be found on AFN's website, nativefederation.org. This is KYUK News. I'm Evan Erickson. Koyana for listening. Please share your news tips, comments, or suggestions. You can email us at news@kyuk.org or message us on Facebook. And stay tuned for Yoktun Ganumchit coming up.